Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Internet's premier, strangely structured film podcast, My Turn. Every once in a while, we here at Waypoint convene to discuss tangentially related movies. This week, I am Renata Price, and it's my turn. So I forced everyone to watch Andrei Tarkovsky's 1981 film, Nostalgia. Joining me today, as always, is Rob Zachney.
Hello, hello.
Patrick Klepek.
I'm here.
And Ricardo Contreras.
Are you sure you're here, Patrick?
I don't know, I might still be watching that film.
I attempted to write a nostalgia-themed intro that flowed properly, but much like carrying a lit candle across an active hot spring, it ended up being a futile effort. So before I do a quick plot summary, I'm really curious how this landed for everyone. I have an impression of how Patrick felt about the movie based on the last 15 seconds.
Don't have to go first. Do not. I don't need to be a wet fart to start the podcast about a movie that you quite liked. So please go around the table.
All right. Kato, I want you to start us off. Oh, I caught you mid bite. Mm-hmm. Oops.
No, it's okay. Sorry. Okay.
Imagine not bringing lunch to a podcast.
Couldn't be Waypoint. Kyle, you gotta finish that before we start the podcast.
I think I enjoyed this film more than I did Stalker on my first watch. Mostly because I think something about, even though these are very similar films in their kind of aesthetic proclivities, I guess. Like, obviously, it's the same director, but it's, like, even, like, compared to some of his other work, like, Stalker and this feel, like, very much aligned in a lot of ways. But something about this one feels like he reined in some of the space and, like, just a bit. Just enough to make it like, oh, okay, you know.
I would describe nostalgia. Like, Tarkovsky's like, man,
compared
I got some tendencies.
Do you remember how long some of those shots are in Stalker?
Yeah, and I would describe them as the opposite. If we watch these in reverse order, I would say Stalker is a restrained version of this film.
There are shots in Stalker that last longer.
That's not true.
If you're measuring it with a stopwatch, yes. But if you're talking about like what a visual interest is happening in the shot, I would say there is probably like the shots in Stalker, I think, like, I see the purpose of them more clearly than I sometimes do with nostalgia, or at least like nostalgia, it is like we're really going to linger over some stuff.
I want to go back and like take a stopwatch to the river shot in Stalker.
It is 4 minutes.
Okay.
I believe, which is less, which is significantly
less than the longest,
less
but the long one the longest. Is also like an amazing shot. I like the longest, which was like what 9 minutes is what,
yes,
what that
it
one
is. A, it
that
is a
one
9 minute
is.
Shot. It is incredible to me.
So oh, good. Shit, I have an alarm. So fucking beautiful. And like, I don't know. Maybe it's partially because the way that it gets set up is, you know, obviously you have the name of the film, Nostalgia. I was already kind of in a, like thinking about memory and dream spaces, like mindset that it felt like a lot of these shots. Like, I don't know. I liked it. I think it's actually, it feels more like what you were saying about Stalker, Rob, but I feel that about Nostalgia. I feel like the shots in, there are some shots in Stalker that feel like we're tone setting, but the meaning making is not happening in the aesthetics. Here, I feel like all the aesthetics are part of the meaning making in like a more deliberate way. And maybe that's because I was already thinking about memory, and memory can be such a, like, sometimes it's dreamlike, and some of these things are either memories or dreams or visions, like, in a way where, like, I don't know. I felt like Stalker was supposed to be something that was weird that existed in the real world, and this feels like it's a real world thing that's interspersed by dreamlike sequences in, like, a much more, like, okay, we're moving between these spaces fluidly and...
Well, it's like, I mean, it's that our experience of the past ceases to be reality, at like, right. Like recognizably reality. Like, so much of this is about the fact that there is the alienated present, and then there is the readily legible but yet more abstract and dreamlike past, and the way the two are, like, woven together through everything. Yeah.
Right, and also, like, the fact that the past becomes a perpetual, like, when you are dwelling on the past, it becomes a part of the present, and, like, this is why the utility of, like, cuts in film is so great, is that it, you know, creates a somewhat causal relationship between two things, and so even when you are getting shots of the past is then explicitly in conversation with the exact moment in which the character, like, currently is. And so, you know, the nostalgia is constantly affronting itself onto the present in, like, a really, like, I think, well done way. Rob, how did you come down to the... Oh, sorry.
Please. I was just going to say one last thing. I think also, to me, even the shots that lingered had more visual interest in ways that they chose to change up lighting in the middle of shots, where a lot of Stalker, like, shots didn't dramatically change in their lighting. Scenes sometimes shifted a little bit, but for the most part, lighting wasn't a big focus. It was more about scenery. In this one, there's a lot of really, really beautiful tricks of, like, literal tricks of light that have really interesting, that make for some really interesting cinematic moments, I think.
Yeah, Rob, where did you overall come down on this?
You know, it's going to be a film that I'm not, like, I'm still working through my feelings about it. I think I'm of a couple different minds about it. On the one hand, like, it is obviously a film of great craft. And I think it is very poignant in places. I think the way that the film revolves around, like, two characters really who are in different ways sort of reconciling themselves with death, and their experience of, yeah, the present versus the past, or the memories of the past, like, it's all beautifully done. And yet at the same time, like, I find it such a slow film. Mm-hmm. And I also, it's a beautiful exploration of a very relatable theme, but I'm not sure I find the theme as interesting as Tarkovsky does, if that makes sense. Like, for me, it is a rather elaborate and, what's the way to put it? Yeah, it's a rather elaborate and detailed study of something that is also a bit pedestrian, with a weird side helping of, like, gender politics.
Tarkovsky notes that this is, when talking about this, this is his most personal film by, yeah, like, a wild degree, for reasons that I want to get into in a sec. After Patrick, bring us around.
What to say about a film that feels like you're watching a screensaver? What to say about a movie that feels like someone left the camera on, forgot to hit stop, and went, well, I guess we'll just edit it together. On a more, like, a more serious note, this is the kind of film, it's like, these films are not for me. Like, art house, like, slow track films are, I need more to grab onto, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I knew fundamentally going into this film that I was going to have to approach it from a different angle, because I just knew, like, I watched Stalker. It was, like, beautiful piece of work. And I knew this one had less meat on the bone than Stalker was going to have. So I knew I was going to have trouble, even just purely paying attention to it, like just on a practical level, this is the kind of film that really suffers watching at home when I can be doing anything else. It's the kind of film that if I was going to get more out of it, just knowing my own personal habits and my attention span, I wish I could have been in a dark theater in which you feel like a pressure that you can't leave, right? Mm-hmm. Like there is something about being in a theatrical experience or around other people in which you can't pick up your phone. Like you can't, oh, well, I'll just, I mean, it's kind of slow. What am I going to miss for the next 5 minutes? I'm going to go turn the laundry over. And I found myself longing for like a way to actually center myself to mm-hmm. have appreciated what even was in this film more, because I regularly found myself incapable of doing so. And knowing that's like a personal kind of bugaboo, like there are times where space matters in a film. And I do think like a Tarkovsky film benefits from like being in a big theater in the darkness. Like this is a space to experience this. And I felt that acutely watching this.
I mean, even people who really like Tarkovsky agree with you, right? Like one of the things that people have described his movies as is like it, making it very clear that like, I don't mean it's boring, but it is about sitting with things and sitting with time in such a way that like feels a sibling to boredom. It's like trance-like. Well, at its best, they are trance-like, and in doing so, like make you feel unplaced from time. And I think that like being in a theater is one of those places where a physical space built around displacing you from a normal flow of time and instead into like the specific flow of time in a film.
I will say though, to me, it almost like, and I think this might be a, I'm not sure the form that it takes serves it particularly well, because like one thing I kept thinking about as I watched it was, I think this movie would be more legible and enjoyable in some ways if it were like an installation running in a museum that like you're not necessarily experiencing linearly. You are experiencing in like loops. Like I was thinking a lot about like various John Comfort works that I've seen, which are like they are films, but they also tend to be exhibited a lot as installations in museums. And part of it is the experience, the way you experience a lot of those films is, you know, as a sort of moving, as just like moving image and sound that you like, you pass into the room, you observe for a while, you move on, maybe you come back and you see something different. And you know, the meaning of it is almost assembled non-linearly, and it becomes like almost musical in sort of the repetition of themes. And I think in some ways that would like, that is kind of how this movie feels. I'm not saying necessarily it should have like that. That's the way to experience it. But I, for me, that is how the film felt in many ways, in part because all those long shots with slow evolutions of what is in the frame, slow changes of the light, all of that is so deliberate, where you are viewing it not necessarily as someone watching a movie for like a story or like character development. You are watching it for to study the image itself.
I mean, I think that this is part of like, and this is going to be I'm aware that what's about to come out of my mouth is an insane comparison. Mm-hmm. One of the other reasons that I thought this would be an interesting one to follow Hail Caesar is that like Hail Caesar is a collection of vignettes. Effectively, right? They're vignettes, but they are interconnected. And then this movie is, in a wildly, wildly different way, also a collection of vignettes. And I thought that, like, it's really interesting to look at the different way that vignette can be used, and like these moments and fragments can be used to like tell something over the course of a film, right? Where, you know, Hail Caesar uses it to create this composite narrative of dozens of people's, you know, threads throughout. It's, you know, similar 2-hour duration. It tells like 10 people's worth of stories. Nostalgia uses all of these vignettes to instead hyper-focus on one guy's experience of what feels at once like a week of time and years. And I think that like it's in that way, it's really sick and really interesting.
Do you want to pause here and just give the outline of what this is?
Yeah, no. So that's actually what it's going to work into, is the fact that like this is Tarkovsky's most personal film, because Nostalgia is the first film that Tarkovsky makes outside of the Soviet system. He makes his first five movies underneath Mosfilm and the Soviet censors, goes through the entirety of his career, and then during the process of writing Nostalgia and through the production process, Mosfilm keeps trying to censor it and eventually pulls support for the project. And so Tarkovsky goes into artistic exile and goes to produce the film in Italy, where the film is set, and follows a similar to Tarkovsky, a Russian poet, Andrei Gorkachev, who is dying of heart disease as he meanders through the Italian countryside as research for a biography of an obscure Russian composer. He's joined by an Italian interpreter, Eugenia, who appears to fall in love with him in spite of herself, feelings which Andrei rejects, leading to Eugenia abandoning him in the Italian countryside. While there, he also meets Domenico, a man who locked his family in their home for 7 years, fearing the end of the world, before they were rescued by the local community and Domenico was institutionalized by the fascist state. Domenico asks Andrei to complete his goal of carrying a lit candle across the hot spring at the nearby resort. Andrei has an equally strange conversation with a young girl before receiving a call from Eugenia reporting that Domenico is in Rome performing a demonstration, which concludes with his self-immolation, unbeknownst to Andrei. In the film's final scene, Andrei returns to the spa to find the hot spring drained and struggles to carry a lit candle across the drained basin before passing away of what is implied to be heart disease. So it is a series of these, like, six vaguely interconnected vignettes over the course of probably several months, but that is left completely indeterminate in terms of like how much time is actually taking place, and is like basically a mirror of Tarkovsky's own experience producing this film in Italy in exile from Russia. And he describes it as a nostalgia, like the name of the film with the H in there, as a uniquely Russian feeling. It describes not just, you know, desire and longing for the past, but a kind of existential sickness that will eventually drive the person to death. And so this is Tarkovsky's most personal film because he's literally trying to reckon with the specific form of nostalgia while making it. And I think that, like, that is what leads to a lot of this, like, oh man, this is really meandering, huh? It's because it's this one guy's effectively diary via film production. And it leaves it in this, like, to me, really effective emotional space. But I really liked it, but I also think it is a deeply flawed movie. I am curious. It is, like, known for its aesthetics, and those are probably the easiest thing to grab onto. Was there like a particular shot from this movie that really landed with anyone?
Last shot, breathtaking, just absolute. Like, there are a lot of shot. There are a lot of great shots in this, but the final shot is one of those like take a bow type moments, because we get the close, not necessarily close up, but it is a medium shot of Gorkchev and the dog that has sort of been sort of a unifying theme companion in this figure in this film. And we keep pulling back as we see them today. And in the background, you know, we now get into focus the like rural peasant's home where, you know, it seems he grew up and he has all these mm-hmm. memories of growing up with his mom and his sisters in this home. And we keep pulling back, and they've embedded that like Russian landscape into the ruins of the church with the vacant windows behind him. It's like three different shots that all recursive into one another. Mm-hmm. And each shot is great on its own. The final reveal with the snow beginning to fall in, you know, not, we don't know if it's August, but the way it echoes Domenico's prayer in his final scene, like that entire shot, that moment was incredible. And then again, like, you know, one of the things that I think there are extensive portions of this movie where I'm not particularly enjoying it, but then there's a lot of these moments where the payoffs are quite striking. And I feel utterly rewarded for having seen that concept unfold mm-hmm. on the screen.
Yeah. Patrick, were there any shots that you liked, that you came away from this being like, oh, I think this is like really like that stand out to you is like, oh, this is pretty. And I liked at least seeing this, even if it went on a bit long.
Well, I mean, weirdly, for as long as the candle scene goes on, it probably could have gone on longer and been just fine. And the reason, I mean, I don't think it's any shock that that would be the scene that I latch onto, because it has the most dramatic tension in the film. And I don't even mean that to be sarcastic, as much as like there's just so, I would be so curious to know how many times that was shot, like what was planned, as much as just you're just going to walk back and forth for several hours and then we'll see which one is the most I'd be so curious on the literal production of how that, like, you know, when the candle goes out, going back and forth, how much of that is just he just couldn't keep it, you know? No, like I'm just it's just a curious shot given there's the era in which it's made. It's like there's what's there is there. There's nothing to hide. There are no visual effects allowing the dramatic. It is purely just the camera and the unease. And I think the part of the reason it stands out is because as I snapped to attention in it, and because it was, for me, it was the most successful use of, okay, we are going to, in some sense, bore you to tears on watching this long lingering shot. But in doing so, it's sort of I'll have to look up which essay. I was actually enjoying reading more about this film after I saw it than I was in the watching, which is also what happened with Stalker. I enjoyed the discussion of it much more than I did of the watching. And like one, I'll look up the essay and credit in a little bit, but like, you know, they were talking about like how that shot in particular, a lot of Tarkovsky stuff, it becomes sort of a self-examination of time. And because you don't really recognize time in film, and this is so true in modern film, right? Like I watch a lot of, you know, movies that come out these days, even movies that are made by, you know, really high-end directors, and things are just fast. When you watch kid stuff, it's even faster. When I watch Sleeping Beauty, I watch that all the time. My youngest is into it. That movie is slow as fuck. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous, but it is slow compared to anything that you're watching. And you just, modern filmmaking, whether by just the way audiences have been trained, filmmakers are, I don't know what how you exactly chart it, but you're rarely given time to become self-aware, like during a shot. And frequently in Tarkovsky's work, you do become self-aware of the viewer. Like your anxiety as the viewer over like, what are we doing here is clearly purposeful. And even that doesn't work for me most of the time, that scene it did. And I found it very effective.
So did you get that, like, is this the moment where you get the trance-like feeling of like, okay, cool, I'm in it. I'm in it.
I don't know that I'm capable of it. Maybe this isn't the perfect analogy, but it's sort of like when I would go to the mall when I was a kid and I would look at those 3D, what are those things called? Where you stare at it and you just see the 3D image.
The 3D eye picture, I forget what to forget.
Yeah, couldn't stereo. Do it. Couldn't do it. Someone else would walk up and it's like, oh, yeah, I can see the pyramid. And I'm like, what are you talking about? That's cool that I believe you that it's possible. And that's just a sort of a shorthand of like it. What I appreciated about that moment was it gave me a window into what people who better appreciate this artist are getting out of the work, even if that particular trick does not work on me. I do not. Whether it's this particular artist and how they portray things or just this style of film doesn't really, I can't get myself into that place. I do think if I was more into drugs that I think I would enjoy this film a lot more. It's been a while since I've gotten high. Can I admit that on a podcast? I already did it. Legal. Hit me up later. But like, I'm pretty sure like an edible in this movie, it's legal in Illinois now. We're cool. I'm pretty sure like an edible in this movie would have gone a long way for Patrick.
Real nice.
And so I'm going to, if somehow we wrap around to something like this, maybe I can, I think psychologically I'm built in a way where it is like difficult to even get into that headspace. And I would like need literal aid to get there.
Yeah. I think the only thing I would worry about is watching this movie high is, I don't know. Did everyone else watch the same? I feel like we probably all watched the same transfer. There's some like pops in the audio of the transfer that I watched that would be deeply unpleasant to me while absolutely blasted. There are some sounds that come out of this movie where I was like, ooh, that was not intended. Ooh, you should have. Was there not a better copy laying around anywhere? Jesus Christ.
I don't think this has like a 4K transfer, right? Like the best I found was HD when I was poking around.
Yep. It is, I believe, the second hardest Tarkovsky film to like track down original copies of, like original 35mm copies of, because the rest of them were preserved by Mosfilm, right? They were preserved by like the Soviet film industry. And so there are a tons of copies of them. This one was a bit more of a limited release and also one of his like slightly less popular works. It's hard to track down, which is why the transfer is the way it is. Speaking of transfer, let's transfer over to Kato. Kato, is there a shot from this film that you like really, really resonated with you?
Yeah, a lot. There's a few. There was one in particular that I appreciated like on a very technical level, where there's a scene where Andre is going to sit at his bed in the hotel, and they managed to take out every bit of light that was touching him, and he becomes this black shape, like on the background. Mm-hmm. Like, he looks like he's emitting darkness almost, is how like dark he is compared to the rest of the scene around him. And as he like tries to stay up but not fall asleep, and then ends up falling asleep. That was like really great. There's also another, like, a very quick shot of what's her name, Eugenia?
Yeah.
Outside of Andre's door in the hotel, I think it was like almost the same scene, mm-hmm. where he opens the door and the light isn't hitting her face, and she's in shadow in such a way that you, like, for me at least, I felt like I was almost like, wait, is this Maria? Is this are we in black and white zone or color zone? There's a lot of moments, because this, you know, we haven't actually talked about this conceit here, but like there's a very obvious, like, black and white is meant to be visions, color is meant to be like quote unquote real, but there are lots of moments where it's hard to tell sometimes which mm-hmm. mode we're in. The one in the beginning, honestly, of the car, you know, after we get the kind of opening scene,
ugh.
There's a car coming in that comes into the scene, drives around and leaves and then comes back in from the way it left. And it looks black and white, just like the scene before it, the opening scene where you have the kids and his wife going down the hill, until it stops and you see the red of the like stoplight turn on.
Okay, this was driving me nuts. Like, had he just crushed all the color out of the shot and the only thing the film picked up was the red, or was it a post effect? Because like, it is such a striking, like,
yeah.
There is no other, even her hair. I was like, am I seeing a trace of the red in it? I couldn't. But that red taillight was burning so brightly. And I was like, he cannot have done this.
I think it also might be a transfer issue, because I've seen screenshots of different transfers that are a little bit more vibrant, but just like had other issues with them. And so I'm starting to, I think it is a mix of, this is a mediocre transfer, and also it is a desaturated aesthetic that might have some post-production on it. You're right, Rob.
Yeah, I definitely feel like the shadow shot definitely had some sort of post, like dodging or whatever, or the other way around.
But we just need to accept that we are in the presence of a master when it comes to shooting like fucked up foggy landscapes and soaking wet ruins.
Let my man direct a Silent Hill film. You know, if we could just pluck him out, you know, I know that's not possible in the current timeline, but let me imagine.
No, you're so correct. Let me see Andrei Tarkovsky's Silent Hill. Give me that world. I want to see Andrei Tarkovsky's Pyramid Head.
Called Solaris, just for what it's worth. So the other thing, so I actually, that opening shot is one other thing I want to call out, because so much of what is going to be happening in this movie is laid out in that shot too. We have the so it opens with like women singing a song, mm-hmm. as a group of women of different ages descend a hill toward where in like the, like against this like misty lake, a pale horse stands alone, and they all like stand there on this hillside taking in the horse, and like it's a moving image. Nothing seems to be happening until one of the figure turns around, looks back up the hill toward the camera, and it freeze frames. Mm-hmm. And it is a thing that like I don't want to call it like when we think of fourth wall breaking, we tend to think of it used like comedically.
Yeah.
But here it is very pointed in terms of like characters regarding the observer or regarding the point of view that we are inhabiting, and that at once transforming the scene in some ways. And that opening shot is such a powerful, like, this is what we're going to be doing in this movie, is like we go from a realm of memory to the memory almost becoming like aware of the observer and transforming it into, well, nostalgia to a still frame.
Yeah. And like, it's so good. The fact that like, I could not tell, there's like a 10 second period where I couldn't tell if it had actually frozen and become a still image. And like, that shit, delicious. incredible to me, where it's like, okay, cool, this film is going to be actively fucking with your perception of time to the point where you are second guessing even what you are actually seeing on screen. I think that's really sick. I also just, there's something for me about one of the first shots of the movie where the car comes onto screen, crosses the entirety of the frame, leaves the frame from guessing like what feels like 30 seconds, and you know it's going to come back on the other side. You know it's going to wrap around somewhere, and then it wraps around in the foreground, further away from the destination that you know it's going to. And then, like, it's this really excellent moment of displacement for me, where it's like, oh, okay, cool, this is going from the background, from the midground into the foreground, and then these characters are going to walk for, like, 30 seconds, a minute and a half, into the background. I think that like one of the best things in this movie is its use of foreground and background, and the way that like people move in and out of different modes of, you know, different areas of the screen. I think it's really, really sick. There's also some like Kata, that scene you were talking about. I actually think that there is a when she's standing there in the doorway,
yeah,
it is a pan back zoom. Where it is like the camera's like being, you know, pulled
dolly
back.
Zoom.
Exactly, a dolly zoom. Thank you. It is a dolly zoom, but it's so slight that I barely noticed it was happening.
Yeah.
For a minute there. And then I was like, wait a minute, this is a dolly zoom.
We're moving. Yeah.
There's
a lot of very small, almost imperceptible movements. One of the like most striking times that the movie does it too is in that last shot, or not the last shot, in the candle shot, like, mm-hmm. which I didn't notice until like the second time around. I was like, wait, the further he got, like we were cropping in much closer. And then like the time that he actually makes it across, like you end up fully in on just his hands. But it like, yeah, she also takes she also imperceptibly, like either, I don't know if she takes a full step back or just leans back into the light to show that then, okay, mm-hmm. here's where we are. We're back in the real world, and you can see who right. she is again. But it feels uncanny because it's also like the camera's moving ever so slightly. Her movement is almost like imperceptible in and of itself. And it's just like all these little things that I really feel build up to like the sense that, like, there, I don't know, this didn't feel as still of a movie to me as Stalker did. Even when the camera moves.
It's more of an urban, I mean, like the setting itself, there's just,
yeah,
even if there's not a what we'd call like traditional action occurring on the screen, there are people,
yes.
there is noise, you know. Stalker is isolated, and
yes.
so I think a lot of that is born out of purely the setting itself.
You know what? I just occurred to me. I think the reason like this feels like a more inert film to me, Kato, is I think probably you're right visually. Actually, this is pretty dynamic in ways the Stalker is not. But for me, the dynamism in Stalker, like there's nothing in this film I think that quite reaches like the speech that the writer gives in Stalker.
Yeah.
Right? Like mm-hmm. there are major like plot and character pivot points in Stalker that, like, this is just a different type of film. And that's what what I tend to look for dynamism. And so I think this is maybe why for me, this is a film of like stillness and not a lot happening, even though there is no equivalent in Stalker really to the establishing sequence around the baths, where we follow Domenico as he listens to the bathers speaking about their trip, but also about him. And then sort of follow back through that scene after Eugenia joins in on it. And we get like this, we both suddenly understand the space of the baths, but also we have been introduced to who Domenico is in this community and like how he is treated.
There's a lot of there's a lot of social space being set up in different ways in the film, subtly or the opening scene in the church and how she's asked to kneel with the other women, and then the conversation that follows about, you know, gender essentialism, basically. But
turns out the sacristan was right, by the way. She just wants a good man to settle down with.
He's more specific. He's definitely because to have kids, right? Which eventually her desire does feel more like she just wants a relationship.
A question of, is she even aware? Like, is she really aware of what she actually wants? Because we see the relationship she's got at the end when she's letting
Andre.
God, he really is named Andre.
Yeah, he's really named Andre.
His father, the poet, movie. when she tells Andre like how she's doing and she's with with a guy and they're gonna be together, the picture we get of that relationship sucks.
She's not doing anything.
Made a horrible compromise for some form of relationship or stability. And what, so you, even is, there, like,
what do you think is going on there? Because I was trying to figure out.
I'm trying not to think he's a mobster.
He's something. Something, absolutely.
He's like a political figure. He's giving the vibe of he's not a political figure. He's a political organizer. He is the political middleman. He gives political middleman energy to me.
We're all just trying not to say a godfather, right? I'm sorry to our Italian listener. No, but it is. Like, the entire dynamic is weird. He is in a formal office. He has supplicants who he's pointedly ignoring.
Mm-hmm. He's eating dinner while two people wait. And then he does this thing where he grabs the edge of the tablecloth, lifts up a corner, and one of them places what looks like a stack of money. And then to me, at least. And then he covers it back up. And I'm like, what just happened here?
But nobody, nobody can say they gave him the money.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, nobody can. I don't know. I know this is me reading more than we were given into this. But there was something about, given that a lot of this film, especially after the initial setup at the top, of him being, he's left Russia, he's in Italy, and the kind of time that it is, that Eugenia or these two people are basically keeping tabs on Andre for just political reasons, right? Any sense of there being more to their relationship to me felt mediated by this, but you're from Russia and everyone is fucking, we're just watching.
Oh, see, I didn't feel that he was being surveilled.
Oh, I didn't think he was until Kato said it, but think about the way that every single character in the movie talks about him. He is always the Russian poet.
Yeah, they never say that he is Russian, right? It's never Andre, unless it's specifically Eugenia referring to him. It's always the other people, even the ones that seem to know his name, will refer to him first as the Russian poet. I think it's also just thinking about the time frame, right? This is, before the wall comes down, they're still lingering even though it's a lot less obvious and you can travel, like lingering, you know, tensions of people leaving and entering. Like Andrei Tartakovsky himself can't go back.
Right.
Right.
Like, is in exile.
Is in exile. So like, that's and why, like, for some reason, that scene pushed me into thinking about like, yeah, is, I think he might be a political figure of some sort, and maybe there's like a underhanded deal happening here. But more specifically, what it served to do to me is like twist a little bit what the Eugenia Andre relationship was headed towards, or could have been, or would have been, right? Like,
see, and this for me, I think, is where the movie really does let itself down, because I think there's a version of this film where Andre and Eugenia are on a road trip, and we mostly spend our time contemplating how at first they don't like each other, but through the magic of Italian cuisine and the wisdom of some kindly Italian grandmothers and like the devout like village lunatic, they learn like important lessons about life. And love. And
someone
love.
Still gets set on fire by the end?
You keep that.
Yes,
easy.
But comedically.
So at the end when the guy's writhing on the ground.
That's like, what like, spicy
I'm being Mama goofy mia. With it. Come on, everybody. God. Yeah, I mean,
can
I think
I,
that,
can I, yeah, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, please.
I wanted to ask a question. I meant to ask this earlier, but I understand. I know, Rob McCowdy, you had not seen this movie, right? This is the first time?
Yep.
Okay. But understand why it's in your wheelhouse and sort of thing. Certainly now, Ren, knowing you pretty well for a year now, like, I get it. I see the connection. But I'm just curious if you can unpack how, because in me, after watching this and reading about it, reading the scathing New York Times review of this film when it came out, I have to read the quote later. It's too goddamn funny. But like, there are people who can be fans of Tarkovsky, but maybe not have gotten to this one, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's a lower rung one for a lot of people, the way you were describing it. How do you even arrive at this film?
I mean, I arrive at this film through essay, right? Through other people's essays about Tarkovsky and about film broadly. And then also my like background in poetry, right? Like so much.
Right.
Of this-
that's the big thing I picked up on in reading about this film was, this is again new to me because I'm not as familiar with his background, but like being described more as like a poet that happens to make films, and so that I see that connection pretty clearly now in your attraction to his work.
Yeah, he is a poet and filmmaker and uses both mediums to the same ends, right? Like his work is, the book he wrote is called Sculpting in Time. That is the name of the book. It is quite literally like the thing you were talking about earlier where you know, the 9-minute scene of carrying the candle is about time and is about him shaping time. That is the entirety of his career, and his artistic practice is rooted in like shaping time in different ways. And this is part of why I think that like there's a conversation between Eugenia and Andre where she's reading translated poetry and she's like, oh, this translator is a really excellent poet. And then Andre kind of gets mad at it. And he's like, it can't. It cannot be. It might be a good poetry.
That was probably my favorite exchange in the movie. I kept thinking about the ramifications of what they were talking about separate from the character. I was like, I've never really thought about what is it? Can you? Yeah. How much are you capturing in a translation says localization? I just kept thinking about that.
Well, and later in her big kiss off. And by the way, I improve on the original.
Yeah, it's yes. It's so good. But also, like, this is part of like the central theme. One of the central themes of the movie to me is like, can things be translated? Right. This is why Tarkovsky has previously said that like nostalgia is a specifically Russian feeling. The version of nostalgia this movie is about is a specifically Russian feeling. And so part of the relationship between Eugenia and Andre to me is Tarkovsky desperately trying to figure out if this can be translated. Is translation possible, right? Can you ever feel at home somewhere else? And like, I think that the film comes to a different conclusion than its characters in a way that I find like really fascinating. And like, one of the questions that I was going to ask was off of this is like, This film is filled with a lot of weird conversations between people, and I was really curious if any of like the lines or like conversations actually landed for folks. And I'm like really glad to hear, Patrick, that the conversation about translation. And
yeah, I missed the next 5 minutes. I was because I've done a lot of like writing and reporting about localization in video games and like what it means to try and capture the original spirit of a thing, because it to do a like a direct translation is not actually to capture what the original creator was doing. There's a lot of debate on how exactly one accomplishes that, and that my wheels just kept turning on that because I had done so much work on that before that I find myself really captured, because I hadn't really thought about every way that I've ever written about it and reported on has always been like the good faith efforts of folks to try and capture the original visions of a work in translating it and localizing it. I hadn't thought about the flip of that, which is someone just taking the position that I guess there's not even necessarily a negative version of this, which is that all you can do is try and capture as much as you can, but you'll never capture the full thing. Mm. And knowing that, I guess there's sadness in it, but it's also kind of, I think that's kind of cool. I think there is something really interesting in the notion that you can never quite truly understand a thing if you are separated from the work. And a language barrier is about, you know, one of the biggest ones that can be created.
I think,
and like,
oh, I was just going to say, like, I think it also, they extend it past language specifically and into culture when they bring up music, which is really interesting to consider. It's like, there's no translating, like the idea of translating music because of its cultural like specificity. It's just like, oh, okay. Yeah, like I
when it's in America, you add a guitar, and then we're cool, right? You know? But I mean, that's sort of like what is gesturing at is like if you were to to culturize a thing, like it gets messy really fast. But it's a really interesting thought experiment.
Well, also, like context, like cultural as context, because that's the thing about Eugenia. She's fluent in both Russian and Italian. She is reading the Italian version because she thinks the Italian version is written by a good poet. But like that's the thing, is that it is a different work, and she recognizes and acknowledges that it's a different work in that conversation. And Andre is still like dismayed or discomforted by that fact. And then we get this again, this same like theme comes up a second time while the people in the spa are talking. There are people who are like in the spa having a conversation about the music that is being played there. And there's this like weird digression about the fact that one of the people who is at the resort likes listening to Chinese music is they're both like fascinated by and discomforted by it because, you know, xenophobia. But It is a really, really interesting like through line for this movie that like leaves you with this question of, can you actually understand a thing? Can a thing be conveyed to you?
Well, I think that extends to broadly, this movie is in many ways about the grief of exile. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also like the movie's openly exploring the specificity of being a Russian exile. Like,
yes.
Mm-hmm. The reason he's in Italy is because he's researching and visiting the home of a Russian composer from the 1700s who, I think he says, like, went home to Russia to die, like, knowing that he was going, like, knowing that he would, you know, effectively, it sounds like he was going to be a political prisoner if he went back. And still went, because after a certain point, the liberty he had abroad was not as valuable to him as like being home, with all the complications that entails. And I think what one thing that comes through here is that, like, you know, there are, for me, the movie can gesture at things, but I can't fully experience them the way like Tarkovsky would, because I don't have the frame of reference. Like, I can understand the power of the image of the farmhouse, and the figures standing by it. But I don't know what I fundamentally don't know what it was like to live there. I don't know how the air feels. I don't know how it sounds there. I don't know what the inside of that home looks like. And I could maybe learn these things in a sociological sense, but it's still different from like living in. I think that's one of the other things here is like, what's translatable? Here we are getting across this notion of being homesick for a land that maybe you can't or shouldn't go home to, being homesick for things that might look pretty hard scrabble and, difficult if, from an outsider's perspective or from someone who sort of moved on from that phase in their life. And yet, like, the nostalgia for these things is real, but there are limits to how much people who are not of it can get it. We can like get the association, we can get the gist, but there is a specific grief in this film that I think is like known to like Russian members of the audience or people of a similar background to Tarkovsky, and this is where translation like runs up against some limits.
This is also like the struggle of identity. Like, one of the questions this movie is like, how do you form an identity? And like, not to lean into my background in like undergrad, but like a distinction in Russian culture is there are two words for Russian and two words for Russian people, Ruski and Rusiski. Ruski is, I believe, Russian speaker who is Russian, and the other one is ethnically Russian. And the question becomes, does the nation orient itself around the language, or does the nation orient itself around a particular ethnic group that is, you know, a small part of a broader, you know, history? And so one of like the biggest questions in Russia for the last, you know, since the fall of Soviet Union is, how do you construct an identity? If not as empire, and if not as collection of like states in like terms of the Soviet states, what does identity look like? And then, you know, this film is kind of about, for me, Tarkovsky and, you know, Gorbachev trying to find some kind of sense of self outside of the confines of the Russian state from which they came. Because if that's not an option, what do you do?
Just to that, I think some of this is underscored by his real, imagined conversation with little girl Angela. And I think it's not real because, of course, he's had visions of the angel standing outside the farmhouse in some of his visions as well. But when he's talking to this child, he lapses into Russian at a point in the conversation, specifically to tell a joke. You know, this is sort of famously like the one that like humor is one of the hardest things to translate. And so he tells this joke about like, you know, the point is people rescued a guy from a slime pit. And he's like, what are you doing? That's my home. And that's like, you know, that is at once a joke about, I think, Russia, but also it's a joke that like is funnier in Russian. At least this is not a joke that Andre is going to tell in his slightly halting Italian.
Right. There's a rhyming to it, right? In the delivery, there is a rhyming that makes the pun. It's a pun, right? It is at the end of it, like, oh, that's my home, is in part like there's a rhyming quality to it that gives it the energy of a pun.
Not the only time that this movie kind of does that too. There's near the end when Domenico is giving his speech, there's a giant banner behind him that says, that is translated to, we're not crazy, we're serious. But the words for crazy and serious in Italian, matti seri, mo matti, mo seri, are like so close together that it becomes this kind of like internal rhyme situation that like does not translate when you just say the phrase, we're not crazy, we're serious.
And then there's the conversation between Eugenia and Andre about faith and about what the word for faith is, that is this difficulty of both translating, remembering a literal word, and also translating a specific idea of faith that is being talked about by this other group of people.
I think, I don't know, necessarily is contradicted by this. It's more, one of the other things that runs this film is early on, Andrei Gorbachev is talking about how he wishes like the frontiers could be annihilated, that the boundaries between nations can be done away with. And later, Domenico talked about a different annihilation of difference, which is that between the healthy and the sick. And he's speaking very broadly, you know, in his definition. I think, you know, you'd say, well, he's obviously talking about himself, you know, as a guy who had a like psychotic episode and has become sort of othered within the community as like the village madman. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, he's also speaking about like all sort of outcasts and people who are sort of marked off by society as in some ways being unhealthy or sick or not useful to healthy society. And his you know, part of his speech is about how that difference needs to be broken down, but also specifically if the world is hell, it is the healthy society that has made it hell. And so we have this other strain in this, which is on the one hand about like the specificity of culture and nostalgia and recollection. And on the other hand, we have these themes of universalism, yearned for universalism.
So I think that one of the things I think is really cool about this movie is that it thinks that Andre is wrong. I think it to some degree believes that Andre is wrong, at least about translation. When there is a shot going through Domenico, the church, the abandoned church, because this movie fucking loves abandoned buildings. Holy shit. the abandoned church in which Domenico lives, which is also just like so pretty. There's like the rain falling in that church. Is it a long shot? Yes. But like the rain falling into like dozens of bottles littering the floor as these two men slowly walk through it for what feels like minutes. That, by the way, that poor fucking cab driver was like, I'm here for Andre. And then after 10 minutes of meandering through this church, kind of soliloquying at each other, eventually they manage to get outside and he gets in the car. Every service worker in this movie is so put upon. Where that one guy shows up and he's like, yeah, I thought you wouldn't be leaving today. Yeah, I had a feeling you'd be staying for an extra 2 days. I'll be honest, I kind of prepped for it. And he goes, can you drive me halfway across the country? And the guy's got to go, yeah, I guess. That aside, on that wall, there is this carving that says 1 + 1 = 1. And this is a thing that, you know, Domenico gestures at, where he goes, look at this drop. And when I put another drop of liquid here, it's not two drops. It's a bigger drop. Which is like, damn, Patrick, you're right. This movie would have been better.
Right? Imagine when the edible hits.
It does become a bigger drop. But also, like, for me, so much of this movie is about synthesis. And, like, realizing that synthesis is to some degree possible. The 1 + 1, when you take two things and put them together, you don't get two things, you get the product of those. And I think one of the things that Gorbachev comes to terms with, and like part of the film's ending for me, is that like he knows he is dying. Right? This is a man who knows that he is dying from the minute we open this movie, even though, you know, it never says it until you realize he's been clutching his heart and taking pills the entire time. And so this is a movie about a man who knows he's dying from minute one and knows he's dying in a foreign country and he cannot return home to Russia for some extenuating circumstances, including his health. Because, you know, the worst thing than dying in Italy would be dying on the way back to Russia is one of the things that I think is keeping him there.
His doctors prescribed a rigorous regime of moldy basements.
Yes, exactly.
This is what is keeping him alive.
Hey, bud, we got to make sure that you're taking the wettest breaths that anyone's had in a minute. I bet that'll be really good as a lifelong smoker.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a lifelong smoker, we need you to take in some damp air. Just really, really moisten those lungs. But he's like, you know, taking these pills throughout this entire movie. And the final thing that happens with Domenico and Andre talking is Domenico goes, hey, I cannot do this. They will not let me do this. They will pull me from the pool every time I try to walk this candle lit across the bottom of this basin, right? And then Andre is like, yeah, sure, bro, I'll do it. Yeah, whatever. And then he doesn't. until he gets the call from Eugenia, and she goes, "Hey, Domenico keeps asking if you did the thing you said you were gonna do." And he goes, "Yeah, yeah, I did." And he hasn't, and he feels guilty about it. And so the last thing he does is he walks this candle lit across the bottom of this pool basin. It's an act for another person. It is completing another person's work, effectively, is what he's doing that Domenico was unable to do. And I think for me, part of that beauty of that shot is watching Gorkachev choose to invest himself in meaning created by another person, right? Like, this is meaningful to this other person. I am going to commit to this. It's the last thing he does before he dies, right? He dies when he crosses that pool. And so he wants to have something. He wants to have something of his life. He's never going to finish this biography. He's never going to return to Russia. And so the final thing he does is an act of connection and understanding with someone who was completely outcast and exiled from their own, like, local community. And I just think it's really well done. And on that note, I think we should take a break. This has been a really fun first half of the pod.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, and welcome back from the break, where you may have heard an ad, or you heard, Kato, how many minutes of silence did you put in for the WePrint Plus listeners?
9 minutes for the entire scene. No, it's a little music ditty. Yeah.
Welcome back. The thing I was curious about is we were talking a little bit about conversations between characters right before we hopped over into the break, and I was curious, did any of the like character emotional beats land for any of y'all in terms of just like small characterful moments where you were like, yeah, nice, yeah.
Domenico's horror at what he did in that interior monologue flashback, like there's a couple moments.
Domenico's?
That's the great question, because this is where we get the trick shot where Andre envisions himself coming to a mirror, and it's in the reflection he is Domenico, mm-hmm. but dressed in his garb, not Domenico's. Yeah, but like there is that moment of for me, what Domenico's or Andre's projection of him has this moment of realization of like the monstrousness of what he did, mm-hmm. to his family out of his fear and out of his faith.
Yeah. It's such a good moment. Just also beautifully shot, the hand reaching, and then you see it first in the mirror before you see it in the frame is like, that's a pretty common thing to do, in film, but like, it's just so effective. I love it so much. It's really well done.
Also, like after he looks at himself, he like kind of crashes into the side of it, and it's Andre again. Like the move mm-hmm. there is really, really nice too. I have a very kind of weird, not weird, but a very weird read on this entire situation. on why this happened specifically, mm-hmm. and what may or may not be the status quo of Andre's family. Mm-hmm. Does anyone else think that Andre's family is dead? Yeah.
That was I kind of
interesting.
Took that.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, there's
or at
the,
least
there's,
if not they are, there's a high, there's a good chance.
There's so the parallels I'm making here. First of all, there's the angel outside of the room that he like looks back on, and there's no one else in that scene except for him and the angel. Like there's implications there. But then tying him, his family, to what Domenico did and the dialogue there specifically, which was like, why did I do this? My God, why did I do it? They're my children, my family, my flesh and blood. Years without seeing the sun, the light of day. Why? And I mean, you know, there's like varying states of stories as to like who made it in and out of the USSR, like in like an okay state, right? And the like locking up parallel almost feels like it's like, oh, we should have left earlier or something like that. It's but there's still a nostalgia for having been from Russia. It's this competing thing in Andre, I think, where he's like, he's either mourning like the death of his family that possibly starved to death, who knows, or it's all just nostalgia. But like, I don't know, the angel specifically and tying it to Domenico and the fact that he's there with his family, like his family's in that field when he appears at the end with the dog, which to me is like, he's dead, he's joined them, right? Like he's been able to reconcile that because he's like now with them in the afterlife. Like, to me, makes it feel like they died and he feels guilty about being the reason that they may have had, like he got out, but they didn't or something like that.
It also makes me wonder if it's actually the inverse of Domenico, right? Where he knows he is dying and wants to leave his family so they don't have to be there. So he doesn't have to be in front of them as he dies. Like that is the thing that I left it being is him being like, I know why you did this is for me, him being like, am I in the way that Domenico trapped his family? Am I abandoning mine for the same reason, which is fear? I'm afraid of them watching me die.
Eugenia does allude to his wife, and it would be like a world-class dick move if it was you betrayed your wife and it's a dead wife. And like it, like that would be like dark Eugenia has entered the chat. So like,
well, I don't think
as far as she knows.
Right. This is the thing.
As far as she knows, they're alive. But there is like, to me,
there's
the stark black and white photography of his memories of his wife. The ways like we see her. Much is made of her pregnancy in those flashbacks, and also we see her lying dead on the bed, almost as if in state. Like there, like the imagery that, but that's all part of a lot of tangled imagery.
Yes,
that is hard to unpack. Is like clear. This is directly what it means.
But like, there's also that line that Eugenia says earlier. It's like, oh, it's been like 3 days. Why haven't you called your wife? Which to me also, like putting it all together, is like, I don't think she's alive. I think he's lying.
Oh, damn. This is where John Hughes got the idea for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
God damn it.
So true, bestie. Now we know what Patrick is doing for this film.
Damn, Rob got me.
But like,
Patrick, did I need to? Oh, yeah, please.
I was just going to wrap up that thought of like, it ended up feeling like one of the big themes was reconciling the nostalgia that he felt for his homeland with what his homeland did to his family and what he feels guilty for.
Yeah.
Which is to me one of the reasons he takes up Domenico's sort of act of penance almost.
Mm-hmm. Anything for you, Patrick?
They stole it. They stole my ideas.
Damn.
So good for them.
Damn. Congratulations, everyone else. I think for me, it's the first scene of Andre in the hotel room, because there's so many small character moments in that scene that I think are just really well done. I mean, one of them's been pointed out a lot, but like he reaches for the wrong side for the light switch for the bathroom.
Yeah.
He reaches for the wall, knows it's there, but it's not. It's not his home. It's on the other side and it really fucks him over. Really, he stops and like pays attention to the fact that it's on the other side. And then there's something. I think that scene is just one of the better representations of depression I've seen in a really long time, because he's moving at this like fucking glacial pace. It starts raining outside and it's like pouring, and he goes over and he looks at the fact that it's pouring. And he's like, I'm just going to wallow in this. Let's make it worse. Throws open the windows.
Yeah.
And then the rain is just pouring in and like pooling on the floor. And then he takes his boots off and lays on the bed in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
He lays the wrong way off of the bed because he can't even bother to like.
And this is that shot I was talking about earlier where he becomes this like almost fully black shape on the screen.
Yeah.
Really, really striking. And like, I feel like. Like, I don't know. I mean, maybe it was just like the once I had that read in my head, it was like, yeah, this man is severely like in grief, depressed, yeah. All of it all at once. And like, it's interesting. They kind of choose for like these, like this scene and the scene before and right after it, that all happened kind of in the hotel. This kind of his act of like turning on all the lights. As this is kind of like trying to stave off,
mm-hmm.
like sleep, trying to stave off remembering, when Eugenia is at the door and is in half in shadow, he like the first thing he does is reach outside for the light in the hallway to make sure it's like, okay, no, you're just Eugenia. You're not my possibly dead wife that I'm seeing walking as a specter in front of me. Right. Like, yeah, I don't know. I think it was beautiful. Beautiful stuff there.
Yeah. The other thing I was really curious about, this movie has like some of the most beautiful sets I've ever seen. Just gorgeous, gorgeous architecture that's like shot really well. And like one of the essays I was reading about this movie talks about it as a architectural film, both in terms of like, I mean, it wasn't an essay, actually. I remember it was a very funny, an IMDb comment that was like seven paragraphs long because the most annoying people on the planet leave IMDb comments for Andrei Tarkovsky's movies. And I respect them so much.
When do you graduate to essay? What is the, like, is it a word count? Is it ambition of idea? Like, I think a comment can be an essay.
Yeah, I think that.
Right? Because an essay can be in a blog. I'm just wondering, like, is an essay declared by the creator? Or is it described by the reader?
This is such a good question, Patrick. And you know what? You're brave for asking it.
Yeah, you called it an essay. But that could have been a pejorative.
No, it was actually like interesting because it was talking about the film as architecturally constructed, right? It is about the built environment. And like the film itself is a built environment. And I think that like I couldn't stop thinking about it after I read it, especially because of the way this movie just, oh, is a movie that loves a wet room, but also just like loves the decay of a room and really highlighting the way that like decay takes shape in physical form. And I think it was like,
well, and that's why, you know, even beyond the way that being in a, you know, as we move into an era in which the big screen doesn't have the same sort of appeal to mm-hmm. like a younger generation, like that sort of, like there's a bunch of movies that have come out this year, The Fablemans, Empire of Sun. There's a bunch of filmmakers making movies about
Empire of Light.
That's right. That's right. That's the Sam Mendes one, I think.
Yeah, Empire of the Sun is the Spielberg.
Yes, yep. Yes. But a bunch of movies about filmmakers making movies about films and about like a projection bulb going off and what that means to them. And there is something about beyond just the way like a being in a dark room focuses your attention. Like, and it's why I asked if there had been a 4K restoration of this. Just something like there's a readily available Blu-ray, but like, it just seems like the kind of movie that has such detail in its mm-hmm. shots that I've got a nice TV right here. I've got a nice projector in the other room. None of them, I think, probably would allow me to appreciate the detail that is here in the same way as like seeing it on actual film projected in an actual cinema. And there's, you know, no way to do that. I don't live in New York, the kind of place where that probably is something happening on Friday night. But like to your point about like how gorgeous it does look and how much it sort of like luxuriates in its setting, like it is the kind of thing that I you just can't appreciate as much when just watching it at home. Maybe you can with Rob's setup. I don't know. Maybe Rob.
Yeah, Rob, are you built different?
I was feeling like I pretty. It was a treat. I was seeing it as intended. Felt pretty great.
Were you transported to the Italian countryside, Rob?
You know, it's this movie doesn't want to transport you. You know what I mean? It's like there's movies that do like mm-hmm. want to transport you to the Italian countryside mm-hmm. and like put you there. This is like leaves you in an uncomfortable, like, again, like just observing.
Yeah.
It's not a tourist guy. It's not like you go at the end. It's like time to book a flight. Like this place seems cool.
Yeah, this is. But I'm just imagining now, like. Do you think he was just too overwhelmed by Venice to even dream of shooting a film there? Like, do you think Tarkovsky got a load of Venice and it was just like, what?
I can't do this.
The whole basement's flooded. It's sinking.
Great impression. Oh, I've been waiting for it all podcast.
Oh my God. There's so many wet rocks here. This changes everything. Can we drain this? Tarkovsky walking into Venice.
Could pump this out, not all the way, a little bit. I want this fresco. It's under like 6 feet of water. I want like 6 inches of water.
Mm-hmm. I want a guy's boots to be wet in every second of Venice. God. No, I mean, I think you're actually, that's a good point, Rob. You are not transported to the Italian countryside. You are watching a dude who is very much not being transported to the Italian countryside. Do you want to see a movie about a really bad vacation? Do you want to see a movie mm-hmm. about a poorly planned trip?
Well, that's the other thing is like, yes.
Next National Lampoon's trip to Italy.
that's the other thing I was thinking, like, you know, I was like, they did remake this movie with Steve Coogan, Rob Brydon, called The Trip to Italy.
Was that good?
The trip movies are really interesting. They are.
There's two of them, right?
Three. They're like, it's odd because they are comics who like relentlessly do bits with each other, but they are fundamentally about like badly planned trips with guys in various states of middle age distress.
Can I tell you a fun fact about the history of the film Nostalgia? Its original title was A Journey to Italy.
Well, Journey Woo! Doesn't can describe a lot of things.
Its alternate title was A Room Without a View.
Stupid.
I will say, by the way, that as far as the badly planned trips go, like when I got a load of the place where he was staying, okay. I was like, I am moving heaven and earth to get rebooked somewhere else that night. He turned that light on and the fluorescent was like trembling and shaking and throwing that like awful light across the scene. I was like, I don't care if the Russian composer left a fucking manifesto chiseled into the wall. Like, we are getting out of this fucking building.
One of the most awkward experiences I've had in recent memory was getting on a train recently on an Amtrak, and then four people get on immediately after me, and then two of the people start arguing really, really aggressively, and then one of them goes, "You fuck this," and he picks up and he grabs his luggage and he tries to leave the train, and then the train starts going. And he's so fucking mad. He picks his luggage up and he slams it back into the overhead compartment. He's like, when's the first stop? And then two of the four people get off at the first stop while shouting at each other. And then the other two people are on the rest of the train ride, like weeping, literally weeping, trying to figure out what to do because the vibes are so bad. Oh, no. That was the energy that the trip that Eugenia and Andre are on had to me, where I was like, these are the worst vibes possible. He gets out of that car and she's like, don't you want to take a long walk to this place? And he's like, no, I don't want to take a long fucking walk. I'm so tired of you and your pretty scenery. This yeah. sucks so bad. Fuck off. We could have parked over there. You knew this. And the bad vibes on that trip are immaculate.
Yeah, what's really funny about that early scene too is that, or at least to me, is that he says that in Russian, which as a person who speaks two languages, you often return back to your original when you try to say something private, even though he knows the other person speaks English. Or Russian, rather, sorry. He knows the other person speaks Russian as well. So it's not actually, she could overhear him complaining about her beautiful scenes and her sightseeing.
It's so good. I think he knows that. He knows that. He wants the vibes to be bad. The vibes Andre is off. Trying to craft the worst vibes possible in the space. Also, let me just say, Tarkovsky, Kato sent a picture in the chat of the resort. I believe, the bath that the film takes place
wall,
at.
That wall back there, like you, that Colin, that is where he filmed that. That is the actual location.
I think Andrei Tarkovsky does such a masterful job of making this beautiful place look like an absolute goddamn shithole.
Well, to be fair, who knows if in 80 whatever it was more of a shithole than it is now.
Please write in, Italian listeners who were in this area around the time.
Been to Bagno Vignoni.
Is it a shithole? Let us know. Write in with your comments and observations.
God. He's such a man with such a talent for making a room look like the worst version of itself. And somehow in being the worst version of itself, also its truest version of itself.
And you imagine how relieved you'd be, though, like, hey, we're just shooting this one in a fucked up, like, natural spring. No one's going to be fatally poisoned on this shoot. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Oh, fuck.
Hey, what happened to the guy you intended for this role? Don't worry about it.
Oh, that's right. I was reading. Yeah, I've read about that.
Oh, my God.
Don't ask questions about the first guy and kind of
Is that did he die because of Stalker? Isn't that the whole...
There's a number of people, like, I think had cancers crop up,
but that happened that quickly. I didn't realize it was. I mean, I read that the original actor was, you know, did die of cancer. I was not, and I am aware of the separately that the Stalker, you know, causing people, or the theory that it caused a lot of people to get sick. I just wasn't sure if they were that tightly connected.
Here's the thing. Here's a note about Andrei Tarkovsky as guy and Andrei as character. Tarkovsky died only a few years later of I believe a heart condition. So like again,
he only made one more movie after this, right?
Wait, no, he died of cancer.
Tarkovsky. Oh right, yeah, he is one of the people who Stalker killed.
Yes,
it was not a heart condition.
Yeah, the implication is that it was connected to that, right? Like.
Right.
There wasn't. Yeah, one or the other.
I mean, that's also what the movie he made is about, which is it's just grim. Christ.
Three. So Tarkovsky and two other people died in the same way.
All
that were all on that set. Yeah.
Yeah, he made. Let's see.
So it was like The Sacrifice.
It's
was a movie
not
after
quite
this.
A sac. It's not quite as, I think, as like deadly a movie as The Conqueror, which is the film that like probably killed John Wayne. Terrible movie, by the way. But this is the one where he like plays Genghis Khan, which it's just on its face is horrible miscasting. But like tons of people, I think, on that set, developed cancer later in life.
But yeah, he died in 82, and this was made in 83.
Died in 86, actually.
What?
Yeah, Tarkovsky?
No. So, the actor.
Got it. Sorry. Yeah. The other thing the other movie that I think of when I think of a bunch of people dying, what is, it's,
The Boat?
Yes, The Boat. It's the big boat movie. This is a conversation that we... Yes, Fitzcarraldo. Fitzcarraldo, a movie that the documentary about the making of the movie is better than the actual movie. Because that director is a weird, insane man.
Isn't that... That's Herzog.
That's Herzog, yeah. God. What a good weirdo.
Wait, did Herzog do the... documentary
of yes
yeah
yeah he did but, both the movie and the documentary, documentary about the making okay. of that's, the movie
good, it's a good way to look. Sometimes you got to clean up your mess, and doing that is documenting your mess. You know, we all make mistakes.
Wow, I don't think I'd realize. I thought he had just done the documentary on a somebody else's film, but it was
no, it's his movie about Fitzcarraldo.
Bitch.
Oh my fucking god!
God, just made 80 people carry a boat through the jungle to prove a point.
Oh no!
what a little freak. But yeah, it feels like we are, now that we're talking about Werner Herzog, do we have final thoughts on nostalgia?
It does. Burden of Dreams is the only documentary cited about Fitzcarraldo in the Fitzcarraldo wiki, which is not.
Okay, so it wasn't him.
It wasn't
Les Blank. So yeah, got so it's
it.
Like oh,
okay,
a.
Okay.
It's a bit like an Apocalypse Now thing where there's a second filmmaker on set.
On set. I see.
Yeah. Right. That makes sense. Sorry.
It would be pretty arch if, like, sorry, I destroyed this production and a ton of your lives, but I made a sick documentary about it.
Hey, that was sort of my point, was like, wow, okay.
I mean, I wouldn't put it past him. I would not put that past
him. No, right. That's why I took it at face value. Yeah. I just,
driver turning around POV, you're about to drive a busload of people off a cliff.
And so the film will be called Fitzcarraldo, he says while driving the bus off the cliff. God. And it feels like since we're talking about Werner Herzog as opposed to nostalgia, it feels like this discussion is coming to a close. Yeah, we only had a handful of questions sent in based on Patrick's prompt to Twitter about different scenes about water flowing. One of the questions we have is, what is your favorite cubic crystalline variant of ice, frozen water?
What?
What?
This is all Patrick gave me. This is the only thing Patrick handed to me.
We didn't get a lot of questions for this one.
What's my favorite type of ice?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Frozen water.
You know, when they make like little pellets of ice that are okay, like soft enough to crush.
Yeah, the good ice. Yeah,
yep, the good ice. Yep. Yeah, it's amazing. Look, I can chew this ice and it won't.
Well,
I do want to. Two things. One, I wanted to credit the YouTube essay that I had mentioned earlier. It comes from. I'm not familiar with the work. I just found it by searching on YouTube, but it's a Nerdwriter 1.
Yes.
And it's an essay called Time, Tarkovsky, and the Pandemic, which is an essay that is just is time to the length of the candle scene. It's really good. And then the other one was when I was trying to read up on the film afterwards. And, you know, I think you might be underselling a little bit of how this film was received at the time, which like the reviews were brutal to this film. The New York Times review, this is just a graph from it, from when the film was released. Mr. Tarkovsky, whose earlier films include Andrei Rublev, Solaris, and Stalker, may well be a film poet, but he's a film poet with a tiny vocabulary, which is just one of the most brutal lines I have ever read in a review. The same eventually boring images keep reoccurring in film after film. Shots of damp landscapes, marshes, hills in fog, and abandoned buildings with roofs that leak. The meaning of water in his films isn't as interesting to me as the question of how his actors keep their feet reasonably dry.
They don't. The answer is no. Everyone's got wet feet.
No, they got damp socks. Every one of those motherfuckers.
Yeah.
It's a beautifully crafted piece of negative criticism. Like the line eventually boring images is incredible.
I was talking with someone recently and they're like, Renata, your condemnatory writing has been getting better recently. And I was like, thank you. And like, this is a condemnatory review, which I respect as a form.
Eventually boring is great phrase.
So I will say, so there's a Tarkovsky fan site, nostalgia.com, that documented I'm just asking questions of Mr. Roger Ebert exchange they had trying to get into a fight with him over an offhanded comment he makes about Tarkovsky. They interview a different person who interviewed Ebert to be like, what do you think he meant by this? And so like this thread I'm linking, it is just like a series of updates as they try to get to the bottom of this. And eventually they do get a hold of Ebert, and his response is, film for 100 years has been about an eye to the audience and a desire to please. So of theater and music for 2,000 years. One can, of course, be pleased at a higher level, but Tarkovsky's fault as an artist was complete indifference to his audience. Best, R.E. And then, like, another full page of being like, well, it's odd that he would say that, because this is what Tarkovsky... It's great.
I mean, he's not wrong, right? Like, I can't, you know, I've only seen two of his works, but... I would say indifference to the audience is.
I do like, not think, for instance, Andrei Rublev would change your verdict on him.
No, but it's a feature, not a bug. Yeah. And I think like Ebert's response is, well, essentially, like, I reject that as like a form of film that I enjoy. I think I'm with Ebert on this one, but at the same time, like, it's descriptive of the work. It is indifferent to the audience's desire to be, and when you use the word pleasure, that can mean a lot of things. It doesn't mean you have to be happy necessarily, right? But it is indifferent to the audience in many ways.
Yeah, it doesn't care if you leave with the meaning that it was providing. Some people do. I like it a lot, but like, that's because I'm a little freak and I know that. You know, I have to read this
paragraph from this exchange. Oh my god, I looked at it when you sent it to me originally. A brief follow-up to yesterday's column. Our alert readers were quick to inform us that Roger Ebert actually has reviewed an additional Tarkovsky film, namely The Sacrifice. The review is, in our mind, not particularly well-written, but you may wish to check for yourself. Which is just... My God.
This is the most 2003 internet writing I've ever seen. It's just like... The clauses, beautiful. The like Reddit atheist, I bet you didn't see this. You should check for yourself. I'm an online skeptic. Energy is just
fantastic.
Seeping.
What a treasure for you to have found this, Rob. My life is better for her. Like, this was all worth it to read this page. Like, my life is enhanced as a result of reading these exchanges.
The vibes are so bad. God. And with this, I think we can bring our discussion of nostalgia to a close. Patrick, next week.
Wait, next week. You only got one question?
Next. It's not.
Rob, the first question was test, good. And the other question was, and test was when I submitted.
Was about ice.
Oh, hold on. Well, hold on. Let's see. We've had two others. Test, never seen this film. Could this make as good a video game as Stalker?
No.
Well.
What about a 90s pixel art point and click adventure game?
Okay. Actually,
so here's the thing. I don't think you imagine very hard to see it. Like, this is such a like Chinese Room style like film. Like it, like that's how it would be made. I think is. The thing that games sometimes do is like the ability to, you can turn around and the scene is dissolved and you're somewhere else. Like the idea that you can be instantly transported to a different context and frame. Like, I think like 100% this stuff is, games do lean into this because this is something the medium actually does lend itself to.
Yeah, I mean, like, to quickly, like, go into annoying theory for a bit, like, games are actually pretty frequently compared to poetry as forms. In some interesting ways. And so like the weird poeticism of Tarkovsky and like dreamlike quality, like I think translates really, really well through like the poetry angle. And so, yeah.
But no. If the shot of the water is slow enough, does it become ice?
Now, this is a good question.
What is happening?
Interesting.
If the shot of the water is slow. I mean, you could get hydrostatic flow. Which is that's always really cool to look at. That's that looks like ice and it's flowing at the same time. Makes you think.
I saw this as a in the Nostalgia Wikipedia page, but I wasn't sure of the context. But this comes Dickie from London. High Point Torinos, long time, first time. Sometimes I feel like I made this up, but if my memory is correct, I refuse to Google this to check. Fantastic! That's so good.
There is a secret Easter egg hidden ending in The Witness from 2016 in which you complete a challenging puzzle to reveal a geometric code, which you subsequently enter into a hidden terminal and are rewarded with the opportunity to watch the climactic candle scene from Tarkovsky's Nostalgia projected onto a wall within the game, the world of the game. As a card carrying the Witness Defender, please note, this is not the same as a Jonathan Blow Defender. That's a very great caveat. My question to you is simply, why? What can Nostalgia 1983 tell us about The Witness 2016? And what could The Witness 2016 tell us about Nostalgia 1983? Thanks for all you do and for taking such entertaining and wild swings with this film series. Fuck capitalism. Dickie from London. I didn't like The Witness, so I never got far enough to see any of this stuff.
I was 16. I didn't play that shit.
Yeah. Rob, you not click with The Witness? I liked Braid quite a bit, and I gave The Witness like 7 hours, and then I didn't want to play anymore. But yes, I have heard that that's interesting that it's in there. Not shocking that Jonathan Blow would put something like that in his game, but I don't know the context. But that's all we got. Except, I guess, yeah, for next up. So struggled on this one. Was trying to figure out where to go. I'm like clicking through the IMDb page of this film, trying to like figure out like where can I jump? So I just started doing some searching, and I'm going to read a quote. We looked at everything from Andrei Rublev, which is, I think, one of the greatest movies ever made, and which you could never make now, would cost hundreds of millions of dollars. But that was a great visual touchstone for us. We looked at Willow, the Ron Howard film, which is one of my favorite fantasy films of all time. We looked at a lot of 80s fantasy, to be honest, like Lady Hawk and Dragon Slayer and Willow. Those were big ones for us because they were fantasy. They weren't tied to a specific time and place in human history, and yet they felt like a grounded reality. Just a quote from filmmaker David Lowry, who is one of my favorites. And I want us to watch 2021's The Green Knight.
I was about to ask if it was The Green Knight. I didn't even know the director of that fucking movie, but you said, damn, I'm proud of myself for that one. Good job, Renata.
It's one of my favorite films of the last 10 years. One of the most visually striking movies I have seen. I think about this film all the fucking time. And it's really good. I've wanted an excuse to watch Dev Patel masturbate again.
Oh, hell yeah. Can we do The Lighthouse next? I love a jack-off film. Can we do The Lighthouse next?
That's how you connect those two, yeah.
Exactly. You know what? You know, you find your connections where you can. And so, yes, that is where we're going to be going next. Has everyone seen this before? Has anyone seen this before?
Nope. You never saw it?
It's just you and me?
I think so. Holy fuck, man, shit.
Rob, like, you are in for a ride, my buddy. You are going to love this movie.
I'm surprised you didn't see it.
Yeah. It's great. Wait, did you? David Lowry is just
hold on.
Yeah.
Rob, did you purposely avoid it for some reason? Or was it just like?
So it was like, wasn't going to theaters at the time. Right, and I just remember, like, I was like, I'll wait for it to come up on stream, but I feel like it hasn't really.
It was up.
So
that's
it
how
went,
I.
It was. It came out like 3 weeks after it was in theaters. It just went to VOD, but it didn't go up on like an HBO Max.
Right.
That's kind of what I was like. I was like, I'll catch it after it's on VOD, and I'll. But I feel like it never showed up.
I saw it on the A24 does that thing now where like they have like a one night showing,
the screening room where you pay like extra money to watch it at home little bit before it goes to VOD. I've done it for a handful of their
films. I did that for The Green Knight because I was really excited to see it, and it fucking awesome. Yeah. So good pull. I think, excited. Yeah, really good pull actually relating to this movie. It's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to go down a road as like how do I find influences? Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, at least from my searching, like a lot of people cite like deeply loving Tarkovsky's work, not necessarily incorporating any lessons from Tarkovsky's work. I'm not saying that's exclusive, but I'm just saying like it was difficult to like find a ton of films, at least ones that like I would want to choose to watch or rewatch. So when I found this quote, got me very excited. If like I love everything this man has done, like Ghost Story, Pete's Dragon. Like Pete's Dragon, that movie is sick. Like it's great. Like I know why he directed a film for Disney.
A remake of Peace Dragon? Why would that be any good? You're going to watch this, and the first thing you're going to ask yourself is, I need to see what this man did with Peace Dragon. And I'm not saying it's like a dark tale, but it's a lot better than you'd think. So, yes, the next turn of the wheel, my turn, is the Green Knight.
What a good pick. Holy shit.
Hell yeah.
I am extremely excited.
The other option was Annihilation, which was tough to not
also
pick,
good.
But I thought fewer people would have seen this, and so I thought that made it a more interesting pick to
don't go. Worry. I'll make us watch Annihilation eventually.
I figured Annihilation would come up during all of this at some point, so it's like that one, that just seems like catnip at some point for Waypoint, mm-hmm. whereas this one, I felt like I had a good chance for a couple folks to be exposed
sneak
to something.
It in. Yeah. Huh. Who's next? I've already lost the order of this. Who's after
Patrick?
It
might be audience pick, right?
Who's next is audience, yeah.
Audience?
Yeah, next audience is next. And then it would be Rob, right?
Yes. Rob. Yeah, it would be Rob. Audience, yeah. Then Rob.
And then back to the original order. Because we went back and forth. So all right, take us out, Ren.
All righty. Thank you all for joining us. You can find everyone on Twitter. You can find us, Waypoint, on Twitter, at Waypoint. You can find our YouTube and video streams on youtube.com/waypointvice. You can find us on Twitch at twitch.tv/waypoint. You can find all of our writing at waypoint.zone. Patrick, where can people find you on Twitter?
At Patrick Lupik.
Kato?
At @A_Kato_appears.
Rob?
At Rob Zachney.
You can follow me on Twitter at @RenOrRaven, and you can support us by going to waypointplus.com. Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.